And Mark Isaacs is my special guest. He's an accomplished pianist and composer and an improviser in both the classical and jazz idioms. He studied at both the Sydney Conservatorium of Music and the New York State's Eastman School of Music. During his career, he's composed symphonies, concertos, theatre scores, and choral works alongside a stellar career as a jazz pianist in a variety of settings, including solo, duo, trio, and ensemble. He's worked with jazz legends including Dave Holland, Roy Haynes, and other luminaries including James Muller, Jay Anderson, and Vinnie Colaiuta. Mark Isaacs, welcome back to Now's the Time.
Now's the time, and it's been a while, but it's lovely to be back on your program, Frank.
It has been a little while. I think the last time we were chatting, we had yourself and another collaborator of yours, Loretta Palmiro, in the studio here chatting about improvised performances that you were putting on. But you've rarely worked in that time, certainly in public, that is, public performances, over the past 4 years, and it's probably not all to do with COVID, and COVID sort of impacted on each of us in very, very different ways. I've heard a variety of situations for artists who've spent the time in lockdown composing and streaming live, of course, from their living room, but also some have said that they've forgotten how to compose. Can you tell us how COVID has impacted your creative output?
Well, it didn't really have an impact because I was very much in a lockdown before it happened and wasn't working much in terms of going out and gigging. I was had some long-term recording projects that I was working on that involved very, very long classical recording projects that involved very long lead times to prepare, as they often do. I was composing, it was just continuing on as it was because I was already at home not working basically. So, but you know, I've been preparing a lot of things and some of it's yet to emerge. I did a classical recording for the ABC only a couple of months ago of my composed classical works, and that'll come out next year. And previously to that, I was working on a CD of classical repertoire, not my own compositions, Chopin and Rachmaninoff, and well, that took months to prepare. So, you know, I'm not popping up gigging that often, but I'm still pretty active. And also, I'm the sort of musician, I do love to do things in public, but it's not only about that. You know, I'll spend months working on something because it's there and I want to do it just for the sake of developing my technique and what I do, you know, call it R&D or whatever you want. So there's always stuff going on, regardless of what's happening in public. But, you know, there's things coming up in public.
But how do you define a standard tune for jazz?
Yes, well, it's interesting, you know, Frank, because I was thinking about this because a lot of the, apart from the pieces that were written by jazz musicians themselves, which have become jazz standards, the compositions of Herbie Hancock or Chick Corea or whatever, but, you know, tunes from the world of pop music and film and musicals became jazz standards because a famous jazz person heard that melody, which had never been given a jazz treatment, and decided to give it a jazz treatment, right? Think of a song like Someday My Prince Will Come. It was from Snow White, the Disney, old Snow White Disney film. And Bill Evans famously gave it a jazz treatment, and he actually wasn't the first to do so. He was the most noticed doing it, but I found out that Dave Brubeck did a version of that song before. And then they become jazz standards after that. But of course, you don't have to wait for somebody else more famous than you to give you permission to take a song and treat it as a jazz standard. And a lot of people, not just me, will just say, hey, I like this song. It might be from a later era, as you mentioned, and from the 60s or 70s, say, for example, or later for that matter. I tend to not go beyond about 1980, but take a song and say, I'm giving it a jazz treatment. So this has become a jazz standard for me anyway. Now, I suppose it doesn't become a jazz standard after that until other people say, oh, I like the way you did that. I'm going to do that song too. And then, you know, but I'm not thinking about that. I'm just thinking that, you know, this particular song by Joni Mitchell or whoever is a song I would like to, or Paul McCartney, is a song I think would really work well as a vehicle for improvisation or reimagining.
And of course, those songs can come from a variety of genres. I mean, when Sonny Rollins recorded I'm an Old Cowhand, I think that came from almost some sort of country and western, spaghetti western repertoire. And Joshua Redman records it himself, probably 40 years after.
Yeah, they're great examples. I mean, it could be a folkloric song. Think of a melody like Greensleeves. I'm sure it's been done. You could do a beautiful jazz trim. I have actually played it in a jazz setting. That's a folk song. It's been around since the time of Henry VIII, I believe. So you're just looking for a melody, right? So sometimes, I had this idea of calling an album Unlikely Standards. I think it's a bit twee. I probably wouldn't, but the point is that it's something that you wouldn't have thought.
Mm.
Christmas carols.
Mm.
You know, I like to use the term heritage melodies, in the sort of heritage within our culture as such. You know, they're part of our culture from various ways, film, TV, folk, pop, Tin Pan Alley, all that, you know. So, you know, the question is, I think it does become a jazz standard once it becomes something that a lot of jazz people do. So at the top of the pile is All the Things You Are and Stella by Starlight you just played. That's very much a jazz standard because, I don't know, countless jazz interpretations of that. And then there's, I don't know about being the first, but, you know, you can't notice necessarily any other, or can't find in the catalogue, say, any other jazz versions of this particular song. So maybe I'm sort of putting my foot forward on this one, sticking my neck out that way.
Do you think there's still that old highbrow attitude that some certain pop tunes don't deserve a jazz treatment or aren't worthy enough?
I'm sure it exists. I think I ran into it on a previous album I did when I essayed a John Denver tune called Living on a Jet Plane. But to me, I don't find that's very logical. Surely the proof is in the pudding. If it works, then the song is suitable. If it doesn't work, but I don't think anything should be beyond the pale. In fact, in some ways, it's quite refreshing to try something that you wouldn't have thought would work. I mean, I like that kind of challenge. I like a challenge. So, yeah, sure, I have encountered a snobbish attitude before that, perhaps even before what I did with it was even heard, which seems a little unfair, is that, oh, how can you do a John Denver song? I mean, think about Bossa Nova. I mean, it's become quite, although there's probably some diehards that don't even think Bossa Nova is a suitable for jazz, but I would have thought after Stan Getz's example. I mean, I think he stuck his neck out by taking those Jobim tunes and giving them a jazz treatment. But they were really ripe for it. They're great vehicles. They've got beautiful changes. And I think musicians mostly, although, you know, it's not unknown to have snobbery amongst musicians too, but I think musicians are more likely to just say, oh, this song is really lovely and I think I can do it. I don't care what anyone else thinks. And it's other people, pundits, not you, but other people who maybe sort of would frown intrinsically on a particular song.
And I like the term you put, that you're intending to paraphrase these iconic melodies in different ways.
Or reimagine them, because I don't only apply my jazz knowledge to them, I also apply my classical knowledge to them as well, especially playing solo piano, which I find a lot of classical approaches really work there. And, you know, so many jazz pianists bring in classical elements anyway, so it's hard to say. But I approach them as a jazz pianist, particularly because I'm improvising, but also as a classical pianist. And I do work out a few things beforehand, you know, particularly in the melodies, that I want to present that part of the melody with this particular thing going on, and I might need to practice that a bit to execute it properly, like a classical player would, you know. So I'm bringing to bear my classical piano thing and my classical composing things and the way I develop. Because sometimes, you know, like the traditional jazz way to develop is to use the chord changes as a template, because that's great in a group, because that's an agreed upon template, and then you can improvise within that, and everybody's going to be in the same place at the same time. But what I've realized is, in solo piano, I can take a different approach, which is to not use the chord changes of the song, but just develop the melody motifically, like taking little bits of the melody and changing it slightly and going through different harmonies as I wish. But you can't do that in a group, because you couldn't communicate quickly to the bass player where you're going to go to next. So it would be just a mad chasing of the tail. But I've realized in solo piano, too, that I should take the freedoms that I do have. Like, for example, you know, you can do a lovely thing with a melody, which is sometimes just to add an extra bar and stay on one chord for a bar longer, or even half a bar, 2/4 bar, and sort of it gives a particular effect. Now, if you wanted to do that in a group, you couldn't just do it on the spot because it'd be really confusing to the other players. You'd have to write your arrangement that contained that particular reimagining with those extra beats, right? But when I'm playing by myself, I can just do it on the spot. Nobody, I don't have to worry about anybody else jumping on that little detour with me because there's no one else who has to deal with it, just
That's right.
And the audience accepts it. The audience would accept it if my group did it, but I'd have to write it out beforehand with the group to get them to do it, you know? Mm. So part of doing this solo piano is to realize, to appreciate the special freedoms it gives.
Now, there has been some lasting improvements that COVID has imposed on the scene, such as streaming, and Johnston
That's
Street
right.
Jazz is certainly one venue that is very, very good at that. But there's also other platforms, such as the subscription-based O-Jazz, which is fairly new to the scene.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on how artists can use this technology to improve the overall scene?
Look, I think it's fantastic to reach. I mean, we were talking about this 15, 20 years ago, and I think the basement tried it well ahead of the pack. I think necessity was the mother of invention, and a lot of people learned to do it during COVID.
Mark, what about some of your desirable musical goals that perhaps you recognise that may be unachievable?
Oh, it's hard. It's a bit defeatist to say anything's unachievable. I would say is that, say, if I look at the classical piano repertoire, there's so much of it that I would like to be able to play, but realistic, it would be unachievable to play all of it in my lifetime, and I would have to select what I humanly can fit in to the time I have. And also, given the classical piano isn't the only thing I do in music, I also compose and play jazz. So, yeah, there are sort of specific things, but unachievable is not a thing I sort of go for, to be honest with you. But I could tell you things that I haven't yet achieved and would hope to achieve, but I wouldn't think they're unachievable. Hopefully achievable rather than unachievable. This is my second symphony, which I've written. I hope that an orchestra will play it. Talking about virtual things, I did a virtual orchestra version of it, but it hasn't yet been played by an Australian orchestra, even though I was so grateful that it was commissioned by the Australian taxpayers through the Australia Council. But I haven't been able to convince any Australian orchestras to play it, which was very disappointing, given that my first symphony was so very well received in so many quarters. But nonetheless, that's the way it is. And so I put up a computer performance of it, which is not as good as the real thing, but at least lets the people who paid for it, I have to say, to the taxpayers, hear what they paid for until an orchestra is... get off their bums and play what I wrote.
Yeah.
Whether here or overseas. But, you know, if it takes some years, it takes some years. It was written 6 years ago, but I hope to be around quite a bit longer. So I hope that I can hear it one day. Or if not, maybe it'll be played when I'm dead and gone. But I hope it'll be played.
Well, and let's hope so, for the sake of supporting the local Australian composer and artist.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for joining us on the program once again. It's always a delight to chat with you. Mark Isaacs, thanks very much for your company.
My pleasure.